Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an impairment conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Impairment as in not working so well. We will be talking about impairment from drugs. How do drugs, alcohol, opioids, benzodiazepines, and marijuana impair the brain? Let's take alcohol, for example. We're all familiar that alcohol intoxication impairs the brain. People stutter in their speech and can't walk a straight line. But that impairment is usually temporary. Alcohol is water-soluble and is peed out of the body at a reliable, steady rate. However, with severe alcohol use disorders, say 35 drinks a week for 5 or 10 years for a man, less for a woman, the alcohol can cause loss of memory and psychosis. It isn't the alcohol itself that causes the brain damage, but the vitamin B1 or thiamine deficiency. This type of alcohol-related malnutrition impairs the brain. All drugs can have short-term impairment effects and long-term or permanent effects, but the impairment looks different for different drugs. Methamphetamine can cause a temporary high or agitation, but with chronic use, the brain can develop permanent associated psychosis and mental illness. With a marijuana high, the brain is also impaired. It's different from alcohol. You don't have slurred speech and unsteady gait, but people struggle to follow simple multi-step directions like walk 4 steps, raise your right hand, and turn left. The person high has temporary cognitive impairment and really struggles with those simple directions. Marijuana is a fat-soluble drug, and it sticks to the fat part of the body, namely the brain. You don't just pee it out fast like you do with alcohol. You don't want to be behind the wheel while impaired by alcohol, marijuana, or any drug, illicit or prescription. The problem is that many type of drugs also cause denial of impairment. The person using does not always have the perception that they are impaired. I can handle my liquor. I drive better when I smoke weed. Loss of perception of impairment. Marijuana can also cause psychosis. The odds of psychosis is 5-fold for daily high potency weed. One study showed 11-fold increase odds of psychosis for kids aged 12 to 19. With continued use and episodes of psychosis, the person using marijuana can develop a permanent mental health illness like schizophrenia. With alcohol, psychosis and permanent mental health effects occur after years of use from vitamin deficiency. With marijuana, mental health effects can be seen immediately or with relatively much shorter length of time. To learn more about drug impairment, I reached out to Dr. Russell Kamer. Dr. Russell Kamer is a clinical associate professor of medicine at New York Medical College and affiliate physician in medicine at Columbia University. After serving as a drug testing crew chief for the National Collegiate Athletic Association and a doping control medical officer at the 1996 Atlanta Olympic Games, Dr. Kamer co-founded Partners in Safety Occupational Medicine. Dr. Kamer has researched the impairing effects of marijuana. He joined me and Dr. Catherine Antley this year as we represented ISAC, the International Association on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, at the United Nations Commission for Narcotic Drugs. To learn more about Dr. Russell Kamer, check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. Russell Kamer, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you.
So I've been looking forward to this conversation since we met in Vienna, and we'll be getting into that. But let's start, as I usually do, letting our audience get to know you a little bit. You're a doctor. We could see you. It's like we're getting a little telehealth visit here because you're at the office with the with the lab coat and everything. So what made you want to become a doctor?
It's a good question. Well, I come from a doctor family. My father was a doctor in the Bronx. He was a GP, old-time GP. So I grew up as that in a medical family. So then as I really after sometime during high school, I found that, I think, I'm going to tell you what, the day I made my decision, it was the gardener, our gardener looked at me and says, are you going to be a doctor like your old man? And I thought for a second, I said, you know, that's a good thing. It just, I said, you know, that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to tell you that the way he said it, I thought about it and I figured, you know, I might as well. Now, I always grew up as math, science. I was interested in that sort of stuff. And then I went from there.
Interesting. But your major in college was physics and astronomy. Things that are out of this world. How did that apply?
Right. It's out of this world. Astronomy and physics. I was always very interested in stars and astronomy, we'd say astrophysics. And when I went to college, I never really thought of that as my career. It was an interest. And actually, I hate to say it like this, but I picked astronomy and physics because I thought that was easy.
That's a good reason. You want to get good grades if you want to get to medical school. So that's easier for you. Like that was like really hard for me. Physics is like the killer. It's the weeder class of getting people out of the doctor pathway, but
yeah, people have the idea. Physics is really math. It's and astronomy part, the astronomy part of physics, sort of the easy part. You know, you like the Hubble telescope and you have simple equations and you think about the birth of the universe, the cosmology. So that is something that I majored in. But when I got to college, I ended up doing a lot of research in biopsychology, which was sort of a new field at the time, as they had biology, they had psychology. But I worked with a professor who was doing a lot of work with memory, and he had the rats and the little cage, and you push the tone, and they'd learn things, and then they'd either take out lesions, the parts of the brain, or give them.
Is that the Skinner box?
I guess that was a Skinner box, right? This classic Skinner box. The beep, and they'd have to get a shock. They'd have to jump. They'd have to learn. They'd learn to jump from one.
My son built a Skinner box for his science fair project. It didn't shock it, but it's just a reward system. But yeah,
right. I don't even know they. Right. I don't think they'd have these anymore. It's a cruel and unusual punishment. I was always interested in psychology. How people thought, why people think the way they do, why they act the way they do. And so I got involved in a lot of that. The first paper that I published, I was the first author, is psychopharmacology, and had to do with the dopamine receptors after amphetamine treatment or haloperidol treatment. So I really was involved in that for some time. So I have that background. I was always interested in psychopharmacology.
What did you learn from the rats running around the Skinner box getting amphetamines?
I learned about how research is done. And I could see how the professor I had, and he was very good, nice guy. He let us all, because I was at Williams College, small college, where we were able to do this research right with the full professors. But remember, I did one study. The study I was doing, I looked at the numbers when I was done, and to me, it looked like it was total failure. Numbers were all over the place. And he looked at that, and he was good at statistics. He looked at it, he said, no, that's okay. We can fix that. And next thing I know, everything was significant. So I kind of learned that you can find whatever you want when you do studies. I learned things I didn't know that I learned at the time about how these, really it's how studies are done. and how, why people do things, why people are studying certain things. For example, for grant money, where the money is. At that time, it was about memory. There was money for, I think it really came from behavioral science, schizophrenia, because what we were trying to do, we would basically induce amphetamine.
You mean there's follow the money when it comes to science too?
Isn't that strange? Of course they did. There was money in that, because then after I left school, I realized then he was focusing more on Alzheimer's disease, because that's where the money was. And that was, but it was the same. Look, he was interested in memory, and I'm not saying anything bad. It's just the way it is. His interest was on memory and learning. So there's different aspects. It obviously is very important when it comes to figuring out what happens in Alzheimer's disease. It applies also to other mental conditions. So I learned that. The other thing I learned is that you can do research with Schedule I drugs, but that it involves more paperwork, because I had the idea that maybe the next thing we would try is let's give our rats some LSD. And
LSD was a Schedule I drug?
It was and is a Schedule I drug. And thanks for pointing that out. So, yeah, so it's a Schedule I drug. And, you know, I didn't know any better. I said, let's do that. Let's have a protocol and just change the drug. And the professor is gung-ho, but then he realized that there was too much paperwork. It's not impossible. You are allowed to do research and schedule and drugs, but there was, you know, more paperwork that he wanted to get involved in.
Right, more barriers. If you really wanted to, you could have.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right, and so that came about. So you became a doctor. You did some research. You learned, what the benefit is. And then all of a sudden, you came to this opportunity, I guess. I don't know how that happened, that you became a drug testing officer and a doping drug czar. Tell us about that. What is that job?
So, right. So it was just a sort of a random event that I got involved, because I graduated at my residency in internal medicine. I started practicing primary care. I'm a GP, I like to say that, but really primary care, or what do they say, PCP, now primary care physician. And that's what I enjoy doing. I went to work at New York Medical College full time as part of a faculty practice. And one day my boss said to me, he met a doctor who was doing drug testing with the NCAA, and they needed more volunteers. So
the NCAA is?
The National Collegiate Athletic Association. So the NCAA, they needed to have what they call drug testing crew chiefs and crews throughout the country. And I say volunteer because it's basically volunteer. They give a stipend and expenses for people, and they wanted doctors or nurses to be in charge of the crews that went around to collect specimens.
Right. And this is every high school sports team, every college sports team is part of this, right?
Right. So the NCAA covers almost all of the collegiate athletics. And some colleges don't belong, but yeah, those are the funny ones.
Okay.
All the big guys are in the NCAA.
Now, and why did the NCAA, was there problems with drugs among athletes in high school and colleges?
I don't know.
Or was it a matter of cheating? Kids taking steroids to do better to win a race?
Yes. I mean, look, the drug testing and the idea of drugs in athletics goes back, really, it's like to the Olympics, or probably the first time any two people had a race, that someone would want to take something to get an edge. And in the Olympics, it goes back to ancient Greece, where the wrestlers, they may drink alcohol or something else to give them some extra vigor or reduce their pain threshold, or increase their threshold of pain. So over the years, what happened was, it was really apparent more in Olympic sports. There's various reasons. One is, like you say, to have a level playing field, because you don't have cheaters. You don't want a person to feel like they have to take a dangerous drugs just to compete. And there is some line between, say, what's permitted and what's not permitted. Because after all, they have a cup of coffee, they take protein powders, and those things are considered okay. But then when you cross the line into, say, steroids, amphetamines, dangerous drugs, those would be considered banned substances. And what had happened is that people had to take drugs to stay competitive.
Right. Okay, so what did you do? What did you find when you went to these places when you're doing this?
Well, what I found, the NCAA was very interesting. The NCAA program at the time, they had year-round testing, which was on site at the schools, which is, we call it out-of-competition testing, where they test for things like steroids, which are training drugs, and then the day of competition, they test for everything. And I don't know much of what they found. My part of it was really going on site, collecting specimens, packaging them up. When I was with the NCAA, at some point, I then went to the Olympics, which is 1996, because Atlanta is the host country. The United States had to supply all the doping people, the doping officers. There's an international parlance, or they call it doping. The doping officers are provided by home country. So since I had experience with the NCAA, then I was with the Olympics, which was very interesting. That's a whole nother level of people using substances. But I think the best thing, if the audience wants to know all about doping, is to watch the movie Icarus.
What's it? Say it one more time. What's it called?
Icarus, like the Greek fable.
Icarus.
Icarus, I-C-A-R-U-S. The
okay.
Person who puts wings and gets too close to the sun. It's called Icarus. It's a mini documentary. It starts off with a man who wants to, and it's a true story, the documentarian wants to dope to improve his ability, I think, as a cyclist. And he finds a doctor to help him take steroids in a way that won't be detected. And in the middle of this documentary, it turns out the doctor he's working with, who's from Russia, is behind the whole scandal that was during the Winter Olympics that were in Russia, because Russia ended up getting banned. There was Russia was doing a lot of...
They got caught cheating.
Caught cheating. And not just individuals, but institutional cheating at a level that is just unheard of. They had the Soviet Union, I'll call it that. They had the KGB officers were taking apart the urine collection tubes, the sealed containers, and they figured out how to get these open tamper-proof seals and substitute specimens so that the Russian athletes would test negative. That's a great one.
Wow.
The other one, which I just saw, is about Lance Armstrong and try on Netflix. And what you learn very quickly, and this is the truth, this is the truth, and especially in cycling, they are all doing drugs. They are all doing something, and they're pushing it to the limit. And cyclists is probably one sport that is renowned for doping. They would do blood transfusions were very popular. So especially like Tour de France, you're going 30 days, however long it lasts, almost like doing a marathon a day, 5 days a week. So that's beyond human ability. And Lance Armstrong was involved, but so was everybody else. And what happened was when Epigen was developed, and I'm sure you know about it, the audience may not know too much, but erythropoietin, which is a hormone that produces red blood cells, that was discovered. And then the athletes could inject themselves with erythropoietin, which is brand name Epigen, to boost their red blood count. Before that, they would actually transfuse themselves. And that was done. So all manner of drugs, then they would just push it. It's the cat and mouse game between the say drug testers and the athletes to see what the new methods are and then try to counteract that.
So this is all performance enhancing, but there are also other drugs, right? Opioids, methamphetamines, marijuana. I don't know if those are all considered, some of them are illicit, but was that also found? And I know it's banned, but is that a problem?
Right. So that's a very good point. There's, in the athletes, we're talking about performance-enhancing drugs, PEDs. But you'd be surprised what's considered performance enhancing, because alcohol at some point in the past was considered performance enhancing. And these athletes, nowadays they're all going to be using performance enhancing drugs. Now, when we're on the collegiate level, where the athletes are more, say, recreational athletes, a lot of the testing is done not just for the purpose of finding performance-enhancing drugs, but to protect the health of the athletes. And it includes, the testing includes drugs of abuse. But at the Olympic level, the high level, it's for performance-enhancing drugs. Now, let's talk about marijuana.
Is that performance-enhancing or performance-reducing?
Right. What do you think?
You know, I guess it depends on what point. I'm thinking about those wrestlers and the alcohol. Like, it's performance reducing, but if you're taking it just during that time to prevent, you know, pain for those wrestlers, it may be good. And maybe the same thing with marijuana. I think it decreases your performance.
That's a great, yeah, I put you on the spot and you came up with an excellent analysis, because it can be both. It can be performance enhancing in a way, and degrade performance in another way, because it's impairs coordination. However, it may increase risk-taking. So if you have a snowboarder wanting to go an extra half a flip, they may feel that they're willing to take the extra risk. And so some people feel that it's a performance-enhancing. It's the first person who tested positive for marijuana, and so it wasn't even tested for, I think, a lot of years, because it was never considered performance enhancing. In the Olympics, they use there's three criteria whether a substance is banned. One, and if two of the three are met, it's banned. And the three are if it's performance enhancing, if it's dangerous, and if it interferes with the beauty and the idea of sport, sort of, which is the nebulous category of.
So what about like opiates also? Like, okay, I broke a bone, athletes are always injuring themselves and they may rightfully be prescribed opiates, but that's banned.
So opiates are banned. Opiates are banned. There's some medicines have therapeutic exemptions where they're allowed a certain amount with medical documentation. And these lists change. I mean, at one time, Sudafed was on the ban list, the minor stimulants. So they change it over the years. So when it comes to marijuana, the first person that tested positive for it was a snowboarder. He had relatively low level. They took his medal away. And then he was on, went on all the late show. He was a Canadian snowboarder. And at that time, it was kind of a joke, but it's not funny. But it made them rethink why they're testing it. And again, just like marijuana use and legalization in general is more of a political issue at that time. What's evolved over the years is that THC is still, I believe, considered banned substance, but they raised the levels. So if it's just small levels in the urine and they tested the metabolites, so if it's small levels in the urine, that's okay. The level is like 10 times higher than what we have in occupational medicine. So the idea is if it's like a rare or occasional use, they don't care about it. But if someone is, say, a heavy user, then it's banned, which I think is a very good compromise.
Interesting. So now, Tel, we're getting into the details of drug testing itself. And I guess we could, with a focus on marijuana, but really any drugs, are they doing blood, urine, and, every drug has a different, half-life, way of metabolism. So how do you tell? And there's always controversy with marijuana about, I used it a month ago, but it's still in my system.
There is a lot of misinformation, just old wives' tales, common knowledge that's wrong about marijuana. I mean, if someone tests positive, whether it's blood or it's urine metabolites, you'll almost always see in a newspaper, so-and-so tested positive, but that could be from use from 2 months ago. No, it just doesn't work that way. So in specific with marijuana, a person who just occasionally uses marijuana, they're only going to test positive in the urine for metabolites for 3 days at the most. That's in a single use situation. And if we're talking about active THC in the blood in the occasional user, that's only there for a couple of hours, 2-3 hours from that's inhaling, because it's different if you inhale or you orally take that. But for a smoking marijuana, a single use, it's not in your blood after 3 or 4 hours. It's not in your urine after 3 days. So if someone's, on the other hand, the regular user is using every day, then yes, after they stop, it may persist in their urine for weeks or months even, and blood for weeks.
So if you're a regular user, so the blood test is pretty much not useless, okay? Because by the time you got the blood, it's already out of your system, right? For like a drug driving case, by the time.
It's really not that useful. And that's why, I look at the work that I've done and that I've reviewed as far as the risk of THC, the increased risk of traffic crashes, traffic fatalities with THC. A big problem with the studies is the time delay between the accident, or we say crash, the crash, and the time the blood's drawn. Because by the time they get into your emergency room and the blood's drawn, it may be hours, and the THC could be out of their system. That's why the best evidence and the only evidence I look at is the fatalities. If you want to know the effect of THC, you really have to look at the driver who was fatally injured, because at the time of death, the metabolism stops and you can get an accurate THC level.
Right. That's if you're dead. By that time, it's kind of too late. And that just gives us a perspective of, drug fatalities for drug driving. So we know that marijuana impairment is catching up with alcohol impairment as far as drug driving fatalities, right?
Right. I mean, we have this almost just about 40,000 traffic fatalities in the United States each year. I think it may be close to somewhere around 10,000 are related to alcohol, meaning someone who's had alcohol above a legal limit. When it comes to marijuana, actually now a third. The latest data I saw as far as fatally injured drivers is one third of them test positive for THC. So that's a big number. That's getting to almost the same as test positive for alcohol. It's in the ballpark. Just like, as you know, the daily use, number of daily or near daily users of marijuana has now surpassed the daily and near daily use of alcohol.
Right. That's kind of hot off the press that the industry is probably celebrating. And that was their goal. Their goal was to get more marijuana users than alcohol users in there. Yeah. And I think they achieved that in some states, probably not all states.
The problem is when we're comparing, it's hard to compare alcohol and marijuana. Now, I always stop because people have different reasons for comparing. I compare it just because we need to talk about the differences, not whether one's worse than the other, or one's legal, one's illegal, why is that? I just compare them. They're totally different substances. I can't think of two more different substances.
One's water soluble, one's fat soluble.
And it's water soluble, it's in and out of your system. The levels in the blood are pretty close to your impairment level, though not exact. People do build up tolerance. But marijuana has, we call, I'm going to use a big term because I really like it, counterclockwise hysteresis.
Counterclockwise distribution?
That's the curve. If you have the dose or the blood level of THC versus the impairment, that's not a straight line. It's actually a curve. And as the level goes up very quickly, but you're not that impaired. Then you get impaired and the blood level starts to fall. So it's kind of has different phases. This is what makes it all confusing, is that the level is just, it's not a direct correlation. Right. So when we have, and it's a problem because we say, I just said that roughly the same number of people are testing positive for THC as alcohol at a legal limit. But the question is then, are those people testing positive for THC, are they impaired?
But didn't we go through that whole philosophy and problem with alcohol?
Yes.
And then we just had to finally just come up with a limit. And some people are not impaired at 0.08 and some people are impaired at 0.05. But we just kind of came up with a number in order to have some consistency.
And I think that's what we should do. I mean, really the bottom line is we need to pick a number and go with it. With marijuana, I could tell you because I've been looking at this.
And it's different, right? With alcohol, we can use blood. But with marijuana, blood is not helpful. It has to be urine or saliva, right?
Well, each one is useful in a certain way, right? So probably saliva, oral fluid testing as far as law enforcement and drivers. That's probably the best test to do because it's easy. It's closer. The window of positivity for oral fluid is closer to the impairment window. On the other hand, if you want to know about your airplane pilot, I think that you would want to look at their urine metabolites because the THC metabolites stay there longer. If you want to know there's no THC in the brain, then you're better off looking at urine metabolites.
Okay, so tell us this a little more. If you're getting a oral fluid specimen, is that just testing for THC?
Right, so the standard oral fluid test. And we say oral fluid instead of saliva. I mean, it's really more or less the same, but technically we say oral fluid testing. It tests for active THC, but there's a lot of variations because you'll find higher levels in people who smoke. A lot of the oral THC is really from people who smoked and it's in their mouth, not that it's in their bloodstream. If someone were to ingest, say, a gummy or a pill, let's say a pill and swallow it, it's not going to show up in oral fluid as
it won't show up in the oral fluids?
It's not. It can.
Oh, that's a big deal.
It's very difficult to, there's very few textbooks that have all the answers. So you have to sort of scroll through studies and then look at the tables and see. But some will get into the oral fluid, even if it's not smoked. But oral fluid testing slants more. If you're positive on oral fluid, that is more an indication of smoking in residual mouth THC.
Interesting. Okay, so the oral fluids, the test is THC. If you're getting urine, then you're testing for you're getting THC and which metabolites?
Right, so it's the carboxy THC, which is an inactive metabolite, and that's the standard test. So standard test in urine, so to go back to the advent of urine testing, how I got involved in drug testing, because I got involved through sports. And then in 1993, around then, the United States Department of Transportation passed regulations requiring testing. It's called OTITA, the Omnibus Transportation Employee Testing Act of 1990, whatever, where all of your truck drivers, airplane pilots, even staff, everyone in that industry needed to be tested. So I got involved in that right around then. We started with the school bus drivers in New York. This helped my entry. So after all, it's my company's Partners in Safety, which let's plug Partners in Safety, that I started with a couple of nurses from my NCAA drug testing crew. Partners in Safety, the initials are PIS, and that's not an accident. That's what we collect. So Partners in Safety was founded, and we were very busy with this transportation testing. And transportation testing is all based on the urine metabolites. It tests five drugs. It was originally the five-drug panel. It included marijuana, cocaine, opiates, amphetamines, and PCP. PCP was the drug.
Right. We called it the Federal Five, and I always said we need a Federal Six because I wanted fentanyl added.
You know, I actually think they've started the rulemaking on fentanyl. Yeah, over the years, they've changed the panel. They've sort of expanded. Well, first of all, they expanded the opiates. Opiates used to be morphine and codeine. And the main reason to test for morphine was because they were looking for heroin. Because as you know, heroin is diacetylmorphine. It's metabolized in the body to morphine. People may not realize heroin itself is not active. It has to have the acetyl groups removed, turned into morphine for it to be active. So we test for morphine. The other test says, at some point, the government expanded opiate testing to include the synthetic opioids. So now oxycodone, oxymorphone, as well as hydrocodone, hydromorphone were added. And of course, look, this was as a result of the increase in use.
The opioid prescription epidemic.
That was at one point amphetamines. I said amphetamines, which includes methamphetamine. We have plenty of people test positive for amphetamines with a prescription. It's allowed, sort of.
The Adderalls, the Vyvanses.
Exactly. We have plenty of people with Adderall, Vyvanse, and they're driving trucks. But methamphetamine.
Yeah. So if they're positive for methamphetamine and they say it's their medicines, they're lying.
Well, not all the time. See, this is where my expertise comes in.
Okay, so I thought if you're doing that, you're lying because you should only have amphetamine.
Well, that's true, but there still are actually medications that have methamphetamine.
Right, but that's rare. You would know that because you would have a prescription for it.
That's correct. Right. Yeah. So that's what we do. If someone tests positive, we verify their prescription. Then there's a way also, a Vicks inhaler used to have methamphetamine in it.
Right. And then you have to look at the, what kind of dime, you know, if it's a S or
the stereoisomer. So,
right. The stereoisomer.
So I'm going to go too deep into the tricks of the trade, but methamphetamine, the point I was going to make about amphetamine, at one point, the government actually added MDMA and MDA, the like ecstasy type drugs to the panel, because they were very popular. I very, very, very rarely see that come up. It's kind of a waste, really, in workplace drug test.
Interesting. We're actually going to have a podcast for those who are really interested in this conversation. I'm going to have Ron Fledger, who's the head of drug-free workplace under SAMHSA, that heads they make the rules for federal government. So that'll be an interesting conversation.
And so fentanyl, I think that's on the drawing board, is that they really do need to add fentanyl.
Interesting. So marijuana, is it just one metabolite? It's not just more than one, right? It's just THC and carboxy.
Right. So in the urine testing of carboxy THC, which is 15 nanograms per milliliter is the cutoff on the GCMS test them. It's a very low cutoff. So that's metabolite. And that shows up for, you said, about 3 days after single use. Blood can be done for anything, but we look at blood testing for active THC. It's not part of any workplace testing, but that's an important test.
So workplace testing is urine, and the athletes get blood and urine?
Athletes mostly get urine. They get urine testing. It's all observed specimen collection in the Olympics and NCAA. The collection, the other type of testing is, we didn't talk about alcohol, right? Because alcohol is part of the federal program, and we do breathalyzer testing for alcohol. One of my jobs at the Olympics, was the first one I had, which was interesting, was I was doing breath alcohol testing on the volleyball referees.
And the referees?
On the referees, because it turned out, I think they had been at a championship event recently, or just shortly before the Olympics, where they were showing up drunk after. It's a big party for officials and a lot of the people who go to the Olympics that they're partying a little too much. So they made sure that they were going to get alcohol tested before the start of the...
Right. So they, yeah. I mean, whatever you do on your personal time, but while you're at the job, you cannot be impaired.
Yeah. And that's an important point, because that goes to, we talk about treat marijuana like alcohol, right? I mean, right. I've heard this forever. Well, we should treat it like alcohol. We should treat it, you know, if only. Now I say, if only we would treat it like alcohol. Because now marijuana has developed a special place where people can, in New York State, the Department of Labor says it's okay if someone shows up smelling of marijuana, but that's not any sign of impairment and you can't take any action against it. And I say, well, let's treat it like alcohol. If you come into your workplace smelling alcohol.
Yeah, people are going to assume you're impaired.
Yes. And you're going to not just not commit to work, you will be driven home, right? Someone's right. Going to drive you home. You're not going to even send them back out. So why do we treat marijuana differently? And one problem is, like you say, impairment. Alcohol, you're assumed to be impaired. You can check their level. Whereas people are very confused about marijuana impairment. Look, obviously, if you just smoked or vape marijuana, you're going to have impairment that's shown for some hours afterwards. But the impairment can last much longer. We have their oldest, I call them classic studies of airplane pilots who used, and this is coming from the 1990s, after a single joint. That's what they were then. There was a single joint of like 10 or 20, I think 20 milligrams of THC in the joint, that the pilot, 24 hours after that single dose, or they, some of them were missing the runway. And they were landing, they were off-center landings. So based on that, it was considered that there was impairment lasting up to 24 hours.
And that's the old-fashioned marijuana. We don't even sell that anymore.
Yeah, it's small doses, small levels compared to what we have now. So the impairment, marijuana and alcohol is very different. Marijuana is more subtle, right? Someone's drunk, they're, say, sloppy drunk and falling around, slurring speech. Whereas the impairment of THC is more of a higher level, the impairment of executive function, of planning, not so much coordination, but it's planning, memory, attention, things that may not even show up on a roadside test, right? We have a roadside test.
Well, I think for the officers who are experts in roadside testing that are looking for drugs, not just alcohol, they're kind of taught that, you know, for alcohol, it's like walk a straight line and could you put your finger on your nose and you could see this slurred speech. But for marijuana or other drugs, it'd be more the cognitive impairment. Can you walk a straight line, which you'll be able to, raise your right hand and then turn to the left? Like, okay, you won't be able to remember those three things. You'd be right. Confused.
That's true. That's why there's a lot of
right
talk.
Hand, my left hand, was it right or left? Did you, wait a second, which was first?
Yeah, but I'm going to tell you something. We'll talk about some fun things. My job as in drug testing now, we call it medical review officer, which means someone tests positive, I interview the person to see if there's a legitimate medical excuse, which means, but it really means a prescription. But I talk to everyone that tests positive. And I'll tell you, people who are positive for marijuana on the phone are much different than people who have tested positive for cocaine. I used to have a receptionist, so she didn't know the results. She'd just pick up the phone, and she would try to guess. And she was probably right 90%.
What drug is it based on the way they answer the phone?
It's the truth, because, yes, marijuana. Oh, why? I don't know. Why are you calling? You know, and also, I'm going to tell you, very polite. A lot of times I talk to people, very polite. Oh, thank you. Because they think there's nothing wrong with what they do, and we have a situation now, which makes it very pleasant for me. Now, cocaine is argumentative. No, that can't be. I didn't test positive. That can't be. How can that be? They want to get the split sample bottle tested. They want to fight. Same thing. Methamphetamine. They never get. They don't. They just want to have an argument and talking fast. So.
Ooh, there's personalities traits based on the drug. I love that.
Oh, yeah.
What about opioids? What do they act like?
You know, the opioid users most, well, right. So it really, everyone has their own MO. Because what I speak to mostly, I speak to people who are taking prescription opioids. They're on oxycodone and hydrocodone. Let's say Oxy, for example. Now, most of them have a prescription.
Yeah.
And it's always like, oh, no, I take it once in a while if I get pain, and they give me a whole song and dance about how they had surgery 20 years ago and they've been on drugs for 20 years, and they take it once in a while. Then, but no, I verify it. And then you turn out, well, actually, they're getting 120 pills each month. Let's say 10 milligrams or more of oxycodone. So these are heavy users. And then, but now, is that allowed? So yes and no. It's
same thing. Are you impaired?
Right. So it's the test itself is considered negative because it's legal. However, we do have to notify the employer of a safety issue. And then that's another level of investigation. I mean, to me, the person's impaired.
So, Dr. Kamer, I don't know if you know, but I did this study where I looked at people who died and looked at every single prescription that was written for them before they died, a year before they died. We did this twice. And that changed my entire life as a doctor, because I would see patients who are alive in the emergency department and their prescription history would look like the people who died. And so when you're telling me about these people who are you're seeing that are seeing, getting 120 pills, they're like, their risk is not their employment. It's mortality.
Yeah, it's very disturbing in a way.
But I bet you're seeing less of that now. We're seeing less of that now.
It's less. You know, it's probably less. I mean, when they started testing for opioids, which was already when it was on the downswing, but there were a lot of people, and we still see a fair amount, but it's gone down. You know, we really, in the workplace, and this is bus drivers, truck drivers, we don't see many people who are tested positive for heroin metabolites. They do. You know, these people have problems. And so you talk about what do we do with this test. When I started in the drug testing, I started with workplace drug testing, I always would tell the employers, I'm a doctor. I'm not law enforcement. I'm a doctor. So when I see someone who tests positive, that indicates they have a problem, and to address the problem, and we help them to point them in the right direction towards rehabilitation, recovery. Now, each employers treat things differently. So, and some are very good. We work with certain unions that are excellent, that take very good care of the members, very concerned about them. Some employers very concerned, and others that aren't. But you know, as a doctor, my idea is that we can help point people in the right direction.
Interesting. So that kind of brings us to your career change, where you were doing working with athletes and drug testing and drug collection, to now you have your own clinic, occupational medicine, and some of your patients are people who they do their drug screening for their employment, and now they're positive, and you don't just get fired, they come to you.
Right. So we help them. We, if they test positive, what on the federal programs, we call it a SAP evaluation, which means substance abuse professional. This is sort of like an EAP type, employee assistance program to assess a person and then recommend.
So your relationship with the patient is not necessarily friendly, right? Because you're not their primary care doctor. You're the doctor from the workplace.
Right. I mean, it varies, but definitely, and I wear different hats, different areas. But when someone tests positive, look, their positive test, it goes back to the employer, and then the employer makes the decision. And you'd be surprised, I'd say with New York City, well, I have to say we have contracts with New York City, so they're wonderful. But you'd be surprised that some of the most liberal places have very restrictive drug policy, like, one strike and you're out.
Do you detect as part of your work people who have a substance use disorder that otherwise would not have been diagnosed?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You know, we have success stories that people who, it's probably saved their lives.
Yeah.
And it's like people.
Deterrence. I mean,
drug testing is a huge deterrence program, right? Oh, I can't do that because I'm going to be tested.
Yeah, and another group that we didn't talk about too much are high school students, which outside the NCAA, because we do work with the school where high school students involved in extracurricular activities are tested. And that is definitely a program where it's not punitive. Like they may lose their right to drive their car to school for a while, but they're given counseling. I think this is a wonderful thing that a person gets to address their issues. So a lot of times, look, it's not the problem. They're having problems with drugs. They're having problems with life. And they need some help. And to intervene early on can make a whole difference in a person's life.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great deterrent. But I do think that the point of deterrence is huge because it works a lot. So if you do find someone that has a substance use disorder, do you also treat them?
I don't treat them. I pretty much don't treat them. We move on to treatment programs. But one thing you said about deterrence, which is a big deal, because number one, in the workplace, it does deter safety-sensitive workers from using drugs, which is good for the general population. And then back to our high school kids, and college athletes, it gives them a reason to say no, right? Everyone's doing drugs, they're going to do drugs. So they can say, look, I'm playing sports. I get tested. I can't do that drug.
Right. Having that deterrence. I've heard that from parents. Parents say, kids say, my parents test me. I can't do that. Or there's a drug-free clubs of America. Where high schools and middle schools have these, it's like a fun program to be drug free, and they have random testing as a deterrence, and they use that. It's like, it's a tool, and it's important. It is, maybe not for everybody, but it's definitely an important tool. So that's great. We learned a lot about drug testing and impairment and deterrence, that you and I met in Vienna, and a lot of people said that. I don't know how many people have said that you are a Dennis Prager lookalike, but
I was straight in my glasses.
Yeah,
glasses in the white hair.
So my audience can judge, because I've had Dennis Prager on the show as well as Dr. Russell Kamer, so you guys could decide. We had an interesting time in Vienna. We were invited to the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs. We represented ISAC, the International Academy on Science and Impact of Cannabis. And so what is your impression now of the whole United Nations and drug issues?
Well, I learned a few things. First of all, going to the United Nations, I always say it's like not all United Nations, because
it was, wasn't it?
And they haven't grown up that much. But the thing that got me more than anything else was just realizing that there is a world, a whole world. The United States is not the center of civilization, and most of the world does not want the spread of narcotic drug use, including marijuana. Most countries have big problems with narcotic drugs. And in the United States, it's almost like we have luxury problems here, that we want to legalize it because we don't want to be too harsh in our punishment. But when we look around the world, it's we're the outliers.
Yeah. And yet what we do, people follow, right? It's like, the United States is legalizing. Mexico wants to also. And now, it spreads.
Right. It's obviously it's a lot of politics, but it's very good to, it was interesting that way. And one thing is, I did meet, I had an opportunity to speak to a Chinese delegation at a table talking about their rehabilitation in China. He said something that I found interesting, because he said that in China, the drugs, they're illegal, but it's not criminal. And I had to think about this for a little while. But really what he was saying was that the drug user is not criminalized. They put them to rehabilitation, not to jail. And that's what we do. It's just that the words decriminalization or legalization have gotten so confused.
But it's a, to compare China to us, I mean, they don't have a drug problem as big as ours. They're very harsh on their drug users.
Yes. And you know what? And why is that? And the representative, he's a young man from China. He told me that, they had the opium wars. Or he said, we have a history with them.
Absolutely. Now, interestingly, I always say now it's payback time, because now they used to be the victims of getting the opium that, destroyed their society. And they went to war over it. And now they're the ones who are exporting it.
Yes. Yeah, it's payback time. Yeah. But they know. And they, not only do they know, they are taught very early on about the damage that the opium did to their society. The century is part of the century of humiliation. And we have the same thing. Here, let me talk, just as we're getting close to the hour, Dr. Gabriel Nahas, who was a researcher in marijuana at Columbia for many years, and he was everything that was bad about marijuana, he was researching it. Like, he saw that, why did he get involved? Well, he saw what was happening here in America with, this is back in the 70s and 80s, where kids were, that was the last time marijuana was very popular. Kids were using it, and they thought, well, it's not so bad. And even Dr. DuPont, who was very good, at that time, sort of agreed, well, it's not so bad. And Dr. Maha said no. When he was a kid in Egypt and Cairo, he remembered going and seeing the people strung out on the street from hashish. And he did all he could to try to stop this from happening here. So other countries have seen the problems, and we've had the problems here. We forget what it's like. These things have to cycle back.
It is interesting that we saw different countries expressing themselves, and each country has a time at the big stadium to talk. The one that got me was Syria, because Syria has been in a long war now for a long time, and they were very adamant against cannabis because it affects really their young men who need to be fighters in a war. And so it's a handicap, and they don't want to have anything to do with that in their country. And I thought, the other way around, wow, if I really wanted, to get at my enemy, I would just, get their population drugged up.
I mean, this is a Brave New World. Everyone talks about 1984. Read Brave New World. I'm sure everyone's supposed to have read it at some point in their lives. The government makes soma, keeps the population narcotized. There's a lot of other things that go on in that book that are very similar to what's happening today.
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting time. Dr. Russell Kamer, thank you so much for your expertise, this fascinating conversation, and you and I will be continuing to work together with the work that we do in Isaac, and maybe Vienna again next year. Who knows?
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.